I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. What is the state of the Vermont judicial system as 2019 comes to a close, and what are the major challenges facing the system as we enter a new year? Well, several years ago, Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Reiber called for a new approach to deal with many aspects of the state's growing opiate crisis. He said the old approach of putting people in jail and throwing away the key was not working.
Basically, what I said was that the classic criminal justice model from Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century, I think it is, the philosopher, the classic model is punish and deter. And the problem with addiction and criminogenic behavior related to addiction is that that is a model that that really doesn't work very well.
Have the state's efforts to adopt a new approach been successful? Are additional steps needed? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, Paul Reiber. Great to have you here. We really appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's nice to be back.
I thought I'd start with some interesting facts about the Vermont Supreme Court that some folks might not be aware of. The Vermont Supreme Court has five members. They're appointed by the governor, and then they're confirmed by the Senate. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, the members of the Vermont Supreme Court do not have lifetime appointments. Every 6 years, they come up for judicial review or retention process at the legislature. The Vermont Supreme Court takes every case that is sent up to it. Again, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, they don't get together and then pick and choose which cases they're going to hear. The Vermont Supreme Court hears every case that comes up from the lower courts, and because of this situation, they do have an expedited process known as the Rocket Docket to hear some of the less complex and less controversial cases in a shorter period of time. And the Vermont Supreme Court is also responsible for the administration of the state's entire court system. So there are many aspects, Chief Justice, to your work that folks should know about. You have served on the Vermont Supreme Court since 2003 when you were appointed as an associate justice.
Right.
And then in 2004, Governor Jim Douglas named you as the Chief Justice of the court. And during your tenure, you've had to deal with budget crises that have shut the courts down for a couple of days a month. You've seen how the opiate crisis has had a major impact on the court system. You've seen a growing number of people turning to the state court system to resolve their disputes. So as we sit here in December of 2019, what do you feel is the state of the Vermont judicial system? Do you think you're in pretty good shape?
We are in very good shape because of the people that staff our courts, the judges that work in the courts, the people in the court administrator's office that support the courts. These are fabulous, dedicated public servants. Let me say something about public service, if I might, Bob, in responding to this. One of the things that I like to talk about with folks who are outside of government is the importance of public service, the importance of giving back, the importance of doing something for the betterment of the whole, not just for yourself. Certainly, we see in this state an ethic that runs in that direction that I think is a model for every other state in the country. There's a tremendous interest from the public at large in service and in giving back. And we see it in the courts. We see it with people who serve on the juries. This is a fundamental component of the justice system. It's part of, if you will, our participatory democracy. It's extremely important that it is and remains as it is a vital part of the justice system. And I'm grateful to, enormously grateful to the people who serve in these roles, sometimes in a in a way that's very disruptive to their lives, but in an important measure in providing good judgment of peers, of people who live and work beside the folks that are coming before the courts for resolution of their problems. So I would say in all these respects, the justice system in this state is extremely is doing very, very well.
You know, in terms of public service, because I've heard you talk about that before, mm-hmm. and it's something that's very important to you. You know, I wonder, do you have a sense in the last, I don't know, 3, 5, 10 years that somehow our judicial system has become more politicized? You know, sometimes we have judges who are identified by name after a controversial decision has been made and people descend on them. Is that discouraging people from serving in the judiciary?
You know, I don't. I hope not. I certainly hope not. I do think that nationally the trend with respect to judicial selection and retention is more and more for politics to be involved. And I actually spoke at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles about this back in June. And we had done some research to look at it, and it's clear that in the various processes that different states follow the for judicial selection, that politics is becoming more and more playing a larger and larger role. That is not the case in our great state, so far as I'm concerned, and I have a good sense for how our system is working. I'm very pleased about the system. Our system, incidentally, has not always followed the same model that we employ right now. Our Constitution was amended in the mid-70s after Watergate. I tell people I think it probably reflected some of the dissatisfaction with government as a whole, that we went so far as to amend our Constitution. This is not an easy process in our state. In amending the Constitution, we adopted the system for judicial selection that we have now that I think is very, very healthy and works very well.
So as you look at some of the major challenges facing the court system going forward, what would you identify as the top couple?
Yeah, sadly, the drug problem in Vermont continues to be a significant concern. And we have another group of people that provide tremendous service to the public, to all of us who live and benefit from all of the qualities of our state, the folks who serve as guardians ad litem in the court. These are volunteers, and they provide a terrific service. In some counties, we have run out of GALs. We advertise on your broadcast or your station, as a matter of fact, for folks to sign up. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing that they do. And I think people who serve as GALs find it immensely rewarding. This is a sign of the times. We've actually run out of guardians ad litem in some counties because of the number of cases. The Chins cases in particular are very troubling. These are cases involving abuse and neglect of children, typically with parents who are struggling with problems with addiction. One of the things we have to come to grips with, I think, and this is what we're trying very hard to do, is to adjust a system that traditionally, as I think I said a couple years ago, was focused on, in the criminal context, punishment and deterring. In the family law context, with Chins cases, children in need of care supervision, these are cases that do not fit into a cookie cutter mold. These are cases that where we need to employ solutions where we actually are reaching across historically lines that divide different agencies within government to collaborate with others to try to come up with a more meaningful solution. So I'm very concerned about the drug problem in the state. I continue to be. I would say as a corollary to that, there's a significant number of cases that we're seeing that involve mental health difficulties of one nature or another in all the dockets, not just in the criminal docket, but in all the dockets. And of course, the third thing I would mention is the number of people who are coming to court without lawyers. You know, we have some dockets in our civil system where up 90% of the litigants who come into the court have no lawyer. This is a serious problem and a serious concern. It's not unique to Vermont. It's happening across the country. But this is something that we're working very hard to try to address as well.
And I remember the last time you were on the program, we talked about the concept of the drug courts.
Yeah.
Has that now been expanded to most parts of the state?
We have. The Supreme Court sits, as you indicated at the start, as essentially a board of directors overseeing the governance of the courts in this state. And this is under the Constitution. This is why the Constitution is written. So we actually sit in a regular fashion in a conference room at the courthouse and talk about policy choices that we have to make with respect to limited means and rationing those means out to where it is that we need to put them in order to address the emerging problems that we're facing. Drug courts is a model that we have supported. But it is a model that only works as we know it to be if it's if the best practices are being followed faithfully within the model itself. And so the court has adopted a policy that I think is very smart, very meaningful to say to local communities, we will get behind you if your community has the resources to support best practices in a drug court in your particular town or your county. Because one of the important aspects of a drug court is that services are available, local services, local robust mental health, addiction recovery services are available. And, of course, this is not easily attained in many of the counties, the rural counties in our state. It also requires a commitment not only from the court officers in a particular jurisdiction within the state, but also a commitment from the prosecutors, from the public defender's office, resources from the Department of Children and Families. These are all important players in the drug court model. And so if we don't have commitment, if the local community does not have commitment from all those individual players, our policy is that we will not support a county, for instance, that is looking to establish a drug court, but it has not marshaled all of the support from all the players that it needs to be successful.
So that's a recognition that in order for the drug court to be successful, you need strong resources at the community level.
Yes.
Whose responsibility is that at the local level?
Well, you know, I don't know if you can assign a responsibility to anybody about the availability of resources. The state has resources in the most populous counties. That's where the resources reside. But if you wind up struggling with this problem, this terrible problem in a rural county, I'm afraid that it is not a situation where you're going to have the same resources available. And this is something that is quite concerning to me. It's what we're talking about is rural justice is really what we're talking about. And I talk about this with colleagues from other states who are struggling with exactly the same problem. And by the way, it's not only with respect to drug courts, it's even with respect to the availability of lawyers. As I mentioned before, access to justice in the sense that people come to court without attorneys is more and more a frequent occurrence. In the rural areas, what we're seeing are fewer and fewer attorneys hanging shingles out, coming to a small town to practice, and therefore the availability of expertise, of professional expertise to people, local folks in those communities is even more rare. So I'm, you know, these are all concerns I've got.
Today in the program, our guest is the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, Paul Reiber. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Amanda, who is calling from Montpelier. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Hi, Amanda.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. Thank you, Paul. This is very relevant to me. I have a lot of support right now. I just recently got out of a rehab in Vermont. Mine was for alcohol, but that 80 to 90% of the women were there for opiate, and that.
I hope you're doing better. It sounds like you are.
Opiate addiction, and I guess for me as an individual, like I came out of there, and I've like. I actually typed something up to Vermont Edition. I typed something to the program reveal. Like, as an individual who wants to help with decriminalizing addiction, substance abuse disorder, especially for women where they're being separated from children, once they're in the cycle, it's very hard for them to get out because the stressors are insane. Like it hurts really bad for me, actually. Out of the 18 women there, only one had custody of her child. And so it's something I'm very passionate about. And I don't know what to do next. And if they're like, who should I call? What should I do? I mean, I happen to live in Montpelier, and there are some good resources. Like Treatment Associates is a great organization and can help me maybe to hear, but like as an individual.
Well, I appreciate your sentiment, and I really support you and congratulate you for the recovery road that you're on. I think it's difficult to start this process, and once you've started, I know it's difficult to remain faithful to it, but I appreciate your courage to call up and talk about this. I can't give you the name of a specific place you could go to volunteer, but I'm sure there are volunteer options available to you. And I, in particular, like your focus on women and mothers of children. You know, one of the concerns I have is the separation of families that's happening as a consequence of the problem with addiction. I may have said this the last time I was on this program, but the criminal justice part of addiction has gotten a lot of focus and a lot of attention, as it should. But what, in my mind, has not gotten enough attention has been the consequence to children and families. And what we're seeing are more and more kids that are winding up in foster care, which is not a great solution for anybody. This is not to say anything about foster parents. People who do that work are tremendous assets and resources to us all. But children need to remain with families as best we possibly can make that happen. But I encourage you to reach out to some of the folks that you are familiar with, that you're acquainted with, who are working in this area, to volunteer your time, in particular to mothers of children. I think your focus is absolutely right on point, and I appreciate you calling.
Amanda, thanks for sharing your experience very much. Let's talk to Alfonso, who is calling from Barrie. Hey, Alfonso, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me on.
Good afternoon.
So I'm Alfonso, and I live in South Burlington, but I work in Barrie. And I agree with the Chief Justice that I think treatment courts are doing a good job in Vermont. And I do agree with that some of the challenges for Vermont is that Vermont is a rural state, and that there is a question of equality or access to justice because it is a rural state. But I do acknowledge that Vermont does a lot with the limited resources that it has. But I do think that Vermont could do a little bit more and leverage the services that it does provide. Currently, Vermont has 3 treatment courts in the state, one in Rutland, one in Chittenden, and one in Washington County. And one of the major challenges for the treatment courts in Vermont, I would say, is that it's it's not really mostly funded through the legislature. It's mostly funded through grant funding, which runs out over a period of time. And that's I don't think that that's a sustainable model. And one of the major barriers for people to achieve sobriety in Vermont or in anywhere is a sustainable sober housing. And there is a clear inequality when it comes to sober facilities between men and women. Currently, unfortunately, in Washington County, there is no sober housing for women. And when you're asking for someone to who is in treatment court, who is trying to, who's taken on a huge burden to deal with their sobriety and deal with criminal charges, we are asking them to focus on long-term sobriety, but for that night, they need to figure out where they're going to stay, where they're going to sleep. And unless they are able to find a sober place, they're not able to focus on long-term sobriety. And I think the Vermont legislature could do a lot more when it comes to contributing more to treatment courts throughout the state.
Okay, Alfonso, we appreciate your comments very much. I mean, people should understand your budget comes from the legislature.
Yeah.
You have to go up there and ask for the budgetary needs that you feel the court system is responsible for. Looking at some of this, you know, the drug courts need more money, sober housing is needed, financial resources are needed to address this problem. How do you coordinate all that?
Well, you know, there's let me say, Alfonso, I very much appreciate your comments, and I think you obviously know what you're talking about, and your interest is important to me. The housing problem specifically is something that the state, I think, is trying to wrestle with. As a matter of fact, I'm involved, as are Pat Gable, our court administrator, and Brian Grierson, a chief administrative judge for the state. The three of us are involved in a justice reinvestment project that was started by the legislature and the governor earlier this year, is staffed by really great folks from the Council of State Governments, and they are looking at a variety of problems to try to resolve what I think Alfonso was suggesting is an impasse with respect to using the money that we have, the limited resources that we do have, in the most effective, most cost-effective, most efficient, most important way to the people that we're serving. And I'm very hopeful that this project that started up just in September and is going to conclude, I think, in January, is going to result in some significant policy choices that the legislature is going to make. Senator Sears is very much involved in this, as are a number of other folks whose interest I applaud as well.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ellie, who's calling from Putney. Hi, Ellie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my comment. And my comment is, and my question to you is, why do we need to lock up anybody for a nonviolent crime? Why can't we use restorative justice for all nonviolent crimes? It seems to me that locking up somebody is in and of itself a violence against somebody who's done something nonviolent. So again, there's also that underlayer of for-profit prisons that give the whole judicial system a lawlessness in the minds of people often. So can you talk about where you are going with improving and expanding restorative justice for matters of nonviolence, please? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Ellie, thank you very much for your phone call. Is this a decision-making process that the court is involved with, that the legislature is involved with, or are you involved together on this?
Well, ultimately, it's a choice that the legislature has made, and I think the legislature has made good choices to support the restorative justice programs in the state that are administered largely, as I understand it, under the budgets of others in the executive branch. So they actually are not funded through our budget. But I do have a serious concern about this. I think that the idea of restorative justice is a very important one. One of the places where, and certainly for nonviolent offenders, I think there's great sense to adopting that model. But one of the problems that you run into when the model is used are recidivists, people who come back into court again and again and again and again with violations of one kind or another. And the system right now, I don't think we have, at least not to my knowledge, the kind of insight into how to address folks that reoffend time after time after time, how to effectively address them. And this is one of the things that I'm hoping a national project that I've become involved in with respect to mental health is going to take a good look at. There's some tremendous people involved in this with a lot of expertise. The project has just started up, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to have some success with this sort of problem.
I think there are a lot of people like Ellie who wonder, you know, they look at the cost of keeping someone in a Vermont jail, whatever it is, $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Yeah. And could that money be used in a better way, not only to help the person reintegrate into society, but also take less pressure off of the whole correctional system?
Right.
But you need some upfront money to do that, I think.
Yeah, you do. And I think that the notion of this, and I don't mean to keep going back to it, but the justice reinvestment, this is what it's called, it's justice reinvestment. And the notion is to take money out of the criminal justice system where it resides right now and to put it more meaningfully, if you will, into the front end of these problems, trying to get to people who need help earlier in the cycle rather than later, which is what the criminal justice system really does address. So that is the notion.
I wanted to go back to something that you started off with. It just sounds like such an incredible statistic, and I want to make sure that I've got this right. I think you said 90% of the people coming into the court system have lawyers?
Some of the dockets, and these are folks where there may be lawyers on the other side of the case. So in a collections case, for instance, where the statistics – for defendants coming into court who are not represented are very, very high. In foreclosure cases, the statistics where the defendants, the homeowners, are coming into court without attorneys are very, very high. We even see it in family law cases. And I'm not talking about cases where neither side is represented, although there are many, many of those as well. But the most concerning cases are the ones where one side is represented and the other side is not. We don't have a system where lawyers are provided by the state in the civil justice courts. Lawyers are provided in the criminal justice arena and in a few other very discreet places, but by and large not in the civil justice system. And one of the problems that this then one of the challenges that we face with this dynamic is the fact that, you know, the judges themselves who sit on the cases cannot be giving the litigants advice. That is unethical. That is improper. That is not acceptable. They can't tell them what to do. And for the same matter, neither can our staff. Who man the windows. They are not permitted to do that, even if they're lawyers. Some of them are. So we are very constrained. One of the ways in which we try to address this problem is through drafting forms. We have form committees that spend hours and hours trying to make sure that the forms that we use in courts in these various dockets are readable and understandable. You don't need a law degree to do it, and provide the kind of foundation for unrepresented parties to move forward in court. We also are about to start a pilot project in Burlington, which we hope will spread across the state, where we will provide walk-in resources for unrepresented litigants on the ground floor of the Costello Courthouse. I'm hoping that that's going to get off the ground by June, someplace around the summer. And I think it's a very exciting pilot in that it not only will provide resources to unrepresented litigants with kiosks, with perhaps pro bono and low bono support from volunteer lawyers with the Vermont Bar Association, but also provide translation and interpretation services to people who come into the court who don't speak English. This is something that I think is very important. It's very important to all of us. It's been a priority of the court now, and I'm very glad that it seems it's going to come around to fruition.
Would we find this to be true in other states, that in criminal justice cases, if someone can't afford to have a lawyer, then a lawyer is appointed, but in civil justice cases, they're not? Is that pretty much true across the board?
Yeah, no, this is a fundamental fact of life in the courts. You know, if you have a criminal case, you get a lawyer under well-settled law out of the U.S. Supreme Court. But that same principle has not been applied in civil justice cases. You read a lot about people who want a civil Gideon rule. That's what the talk is about. Gideon is the name of the U.S. Supreme Court case that established the principle that criminal defendants will have lawyers paid by the state. But so far, you know, we have in our legislature, to their great credit, has provided for lawyers, for instance, in Chin's cases to the parties. These are civil cases. These are not criminal cases.
These are the children cases.
Children in need of care and supervision. Yeah. So that is part of the Public Defender Act. It's provided in what the legislature passed as part of the Public Defender Act. And we are one of a number of states that have done that. Not every state has done that. So our folks have really worked hard to address where I think we might all agree are the most critical concerns. But there are many, many other concerns that are left with the unrepresented parties, for sure.
Let's talk to Lisa, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My question has to do with family court, and I want to commend the judges in family court because they constantly take the approach of, you know, our goal here is to help this child and help the family, which is wonderful. But I don't think that the system as such supports their ability to do that. And what I mean by that is that when it's an adversarial process, there's a lot of, you know, focus on blame and fault and not much on fixing problems. DCF is very overloaded, as many know, and I have found in my experience that in between hearings, the things that the judge asked to be done don't happen. So months and months drag on, and everyone's time is wasted. And I wonder if the court's time and the all parties' time might be better spent in more of a mediation focus or a working group focus.
Well, thanks. That's an interesting point. I certainly think that mediation, alternative dispute resolution, is a very important place in the family law courts. We, I'm sure, could. You know, we'd be benefited, I'm sure, if there was more of it that was going on. And you're right about the problems. I appreciate your positive sentiment about the judges. I'm always amazed and quite humbled, to be honest with you, with the work that our judges are doing in the courts all across the state and staff, for that matter, and in particular in these family law cases where you perhaps know well, there are very high emotions that run, and it's quite understandable, of course. We're talking about the custody of children, We're talking about the most important sorts of matters in an individual's personal life, a parent's personal life, and a child's life. And so it's quite high tension. It can be very, very high tension. And our judges, believe me, are just the most amazing and wonderful people, as you so rightly suggest. And I really appreciate that. I think the thing, if I was going to remark on what concerns me the most about the CHINS child protection system right now, it is the timetable that we're seeing for cases to reach resolution. I'm quite concerned about that. We have so many cases with a system that has such disparate parts. And by that, I mean attorneys, for instance, who are doing great work for the public defender's office, but are stretched so thin that they're representing parties in multiple counties at the same time and can't be scheduled to complete a hearing that has started where the judge has got to take evidence on who is competent, who is capable of taking custody of children under some extreme circumstances. These are very serious problems, systemic problems, not within our ability to control directly. But I don't say that as a defense to my own responsibility. As a matter of fact, to the contrary, I think we as judges in this state have a very important role to play in trying to solve problems that we don't necessarily have within our own discrete ability to accomplish, but we can help to accomplish a resolution by bringing people to the table, by asking folks in the other branches to meet us and talk about these problems and try to address them in a better way. And so I'm a big fan of collaboration across the branches, and I think that we're doing quite a lot of that. I'm hopeful that it's going to bear fruit. I frankly think that in a lot of ways our state is ahead of many other states that are wrestling with exactly the same problems, but that's no, to me, that's not at all satisfying. We need to address these problems, and I appreciate your comments.
Lisa, thanks for your phone call. Let's talk to Joe, who is calling from Eden Mills. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I just had a couple questions and comments about the restorative justice. I had spent quite a few years incarcerated in the state, and on several occasions during my court proceedings, I had brought up the restorative justice statute to the prosecuting attorney. And it was of the opinion of the prosecuting state's attorney in a couple different counties that restorative justice is only for civil matters, and it's also for criminal matters. And I was just kind of, that was my comment. My question was, how do we get the state's attorneys in the state to realize that restorative justice is also for criminal proceedings, and it does do a lot of good to, for the victims and the offenders in situations, a lot of them.
Well, thanks, Joe. I appreciate your question, and congratulations on navigating through the system and being back to having a regular place and status within the society and community at large. I think that the restorative justice system, I'm not aware of it being used in the civil context, and it's possible that it has been in some measure in some places, but I frankly don't think so. It's a criminal justice tool, and whoever told you that, I think was mistaken, but that's my take on it.
I wanted to ask you about bail. I think we have a number of people who are awaiting trial in jail.
Right.
They haven't been convicted yet, but they're still in prison because they can't meet the requirement for cash bail. So do we have a system that says, hey, if you have money and you're charged with a crime, you can meet bail and go home, but if you don't have the money, we're going to keep you in jail?
Well, the system does require the judges to make an assessment of the ability to pay, and that is something that is accounted for in the process that the courts follow. this is an important question, and it's a very current issue across the country in all the states, as well as here in Vermont. As you may know, there are a couple of states that have actually said that they've done away with bail, although if you look at the details, it's not maybe entirely true, but it looks like it is close to that. And I think that we have, serious interest here in bail reform. There's a national report on fines and fees that came out, as you may be aware, Bob, after the terrible rioting that occurred in Ferguson, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis several years ago, where the Department of Justice investigated and found that the court system were actually using bail, fines, and fees as they said, an ATM machine. This is not acceptable. It's not something that we do, so far as I'm concerned. I do think that we're sensitive to ability to pay as required by the law, and I think the conversation will continue about it because it's an important topic.
Would you like to see the legislature address the issue of bail reform?
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, I think it's and I, sitting here, I can't tell you that they've not done it. I'm not exactly sure where they are on it, but I think it's an important topic for discussion for sure.
Is the purpose of bail to prevent a flight risk? Is it to protect public safety? Both?
Yeah, I think both. Yeah. It's all of that, and you know, but it should not amount to a presumption of guilt. It should not amount to a situation where defendants who have the ability to pay, have resources, are able to be free on the street, and those who do not have the same resources available to them, but stand in equal measure in all other respects. I think there's a serious question about whether or not the same rules apply.
Well, this has been a fascinating and educational look at the working of the Vermont Supreme Court and the state's entire judicial system. Paul Reiber, Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, many thanks for being on the program today and sharing your thoughts with our listeners. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thanks.